I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Every criminal leaves a fingerprint at the scene of the crime. The fictitious super sleuth Sherlock Holmes would have agreed with that sentiment, even though the science wasn't widely used in his time. It was in the early 20th century that forensics revolutionized detection. Out went voodoo sciences like phrenology. You couldn't get convicted anymore just because your face had a dodgy demeanor or your thumbs were short and bent. Experts in their lab coats became the backroom stars of the courtroom, sealing convictions with blood samples, handwriting, skin cells and hair, and the gold standard of evidence, fingerprints. But recently, that standard has been tarnished. Ask Brandon Mayfield about that. The Oregon lawyer was arrested and thrown into jail after the FBI matched his prints to those on a bag near the scene of the Madrid bombing. But they were both wrong. They said sorry, and Mayfield was freed, but the case has the very credibility of fingerprint identification on the stand. Connection listeners, do you have faith in fingerprints, or is today's science tomorrow's irreversible mistake? You can't say sorry for an execution. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Brandon Mayfield joins us now by telephone from Portland, Oregon. Brandon, thanks for joining us. Tell us your story.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Morning.
Actually, I guess the start would be May 6th when I left my modest home in Oregon. I'm actually in Beaverton right now. I work in Portland, Oregon. It was a day like any other day, dropped off my kids at school, probably arrived at the office about 9 o'clock. I got a knock at the door, I'm just guessing around 10 in the morning, and I thought it was unusual because I usually have an appointment for clients, and I didn't have anything scheduled. I thought maybe it was solicitors, just went to the door thinking that I would, you know, say hi, send them away, open the door, said hello, you know, what can I do for you, and there was two agents, FBI agents, dressed in black, one male, one female. They said that they identified themselves as FBI agents almost immediately and said that they wanted to talk to me. And they quickly pushed their way in the door. I mean, not physically pushing me out of the way, but kind of worked their way into my office. And I think at that point I said something to the effect that, you know, if you have any questions for me, put it to me in writing and I'll get back to you. And that didn't work. That approach didn't work.
Was it clear to you why they were there, what you were under suspicion of?
No. I mean, I had no idea this was connected to the Madrid, Spain bombing. No inkling in my mind. But I wasn't actually surprised that they were there because I'm an American attorney. I'm a Muslim, and I'm a member of the local Muslim community. I go to a local mosque, which is an equivalent to a church or a synagogue. And I'd had other members of our community, Muslim members, say that they had been approached by the FBI and, you know, questioned. And they, knowing I was an attorney, asking me, you know, how do we respond to this? And go ahead.
Did you actually get angry with them when they were there? Did you think you were being profiled? I mean, you said they haven't actually told you what you're under suspicion of.
I don't think I was angry. I just a lot of Muslims are afraid that they're being watched, going to be watched, going to be questioned. So it's not really a surprise.
You were scared?
Not initially. No, I wasn't scared. I just thought they were there to do what they're supposed to do. I guess you could say that they're. They're want to ask some questions. I don't have my feeling was I don't have to answer them, and I instruct even others who come to me. If the FBI does come to you, you don't have to answer the questions and get an attorney.
When did they actually tell you that they'd found a fingerprint near the scene of the Madrid bombing, and you were a match?
That's a good question. I don't think they actually did that. I mean, when they came in, they immediately said they had a warrant for my arrest, a search warrant, and my concern was, you know, who authorized this? Read me the search warrant, which they did. Show me the affidavit in support of the search warrant, which they gave it to me. And I went to the bottom line and found out it was a local federal district court judge. And I was a little hurt because I knew I didn't do anything wrong. And my reaction was, let's go. That's when I got mad. I said, let's go to the courthouse, you know, the federal courthouse. Let's straighten this out, which they happily obliged. In other words, they frisked me, patted me down, handcuffed me in my office, and, you know, read me the search warrant, which was rather lengthy. And at some point in the search warrant with all these other details of things that they're looking for, they said detonator caps, you know, bomb-making material. And that did perk my interest. But, I didn't know if this is routine search warrant language. I'd never been, you know, subject to something like this before.
Okay, you were new to the game, so let's bring in your attorney because we have Stephen Wex. He joins us by telephone from Oregon. Mr. Wex is a federal public defender for the District of Oregon. So he
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. So you picked up the case. Did they tell you what the evidence was against your client straight up?
Yes. As soon as, you know, the first appearance was made by Mr. Mayfield with a friend of his who is a civil attorney, as soon as that first appearance was over, that lawyer, Mr. Nelson, called our office, and one of my assistants, you know, got into the case that evening, went and saw Mr. Mayfield, and we took it from there the following day. And we knew from the outset what the government was alleging, because they had provided us a copy of the material witness warrant affidavit, which spelled out what the government believed to be the 100% match.
And this was just one print, was it, which matched your client's, according to the FBI, your client's print, which he'd given when he went into the armed services. And they'd done it, what, by computer from a print sent by the Spanish authorities?
The Spanish authorities had apparently sent the print through Interpol to the United States and a number of European countries, you know, seeking assistance, asking a number of countries to search their databases. The FBI ran the print through what is called the IAFIS database, which is a computerized system that has 45 to 50 million prints in it. People who have been in the military, people who have been involved with the law, perhaps.
Well, was this faxed over, Stephen? I was wondering about how good a copy it was. Was it faxed through via Interpol?
No, my understanding is that this was sent via email through the Internet. And when we eventually got a copy of the print here in Oregon, it was emailed by the FBI in on the East Coast to the FBI here, downloaded to a CD-ROM. And my understanding is that there is minimal degradation in the quality of a print when it's sent in that way.
Indeed, you actually hired your own expert, Ken Moses, and he came in. He was supposed to be your best defense witness. He verified it, didn't he? So how did it actually get found out to be false?
Well, that was through the Spanish. The, you know, public documents in the case show that the Spaniards had been provided a copy of Mr. Mayfield's prints, and their check said, no, this is not a match. And then eventually the Spanish apparently concluded that this was a match to a Mr. Daoud. Now, it's important to note that while Mr. Moses did find a match, that what is on the public record from him is that it was a very difficult process. There was some distortion, some blotting out, and that in order for him to reach what he called an ultimate determination of authenticity, he would have wanted to see additional information.
It does seem incredible, though, that you bring in a top expert and he says, yes, I totally verify it. I mean, did you think this just proves that fingerprinting evidence is not reliable?
The answer I can give to that is it raises questions about the process, how it happens, and about some of the psychological dynamics that go on. And I think that one of the things that may follow from this is that some of the psychologists who deal with human memory, suggestiveness, and identification procedures might start looking at the same type of, you know, psychological forces that are, you know, at issue in this type of proceeding as well.
Let's hear a final word from Brandon Mayfield. Brandon, you were under arrest for 2 weeks when you hadn't even been to Spain at all. What are your final thoughts? You've had an apology now. They admitted they've got it wrong. What are your final thoughts?
It's hard to say. I don't want this to happen to somebody else again. I mean, it may be, I'm sorry, it may be that there's others in my shoes that have been convicted on flimsier evidence or forensics, and they're still languishing away in jail or prison. And I think this was an abuse of the material witness statute. So, I mean, my hope and prayer is that that something good comes out of this, that the science becomes a little more exacting.
Brandon Mayfield, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks also to your lawyer, Stephen Wax. So let's get a couple of experts in on this. We're joined from a studio in Philadelphia by Robert Epstein. He's an assistant federal defender in Philadelphia. He was one of the first lawyers to challenge the science of fingerprint evidence in court. With the studio here with me in Boston is Pat Wertheim. He's a fingerprint analyst for the Arizona Department of Public Safety. He's been involved in the fingerprinting field for almost 30 years, so we couldn't have two better experts. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Robert Epstein, hearing what Brandon Mayfield and his lawyer were saying there, are you saying it's exactly what I've been saying for years?
Yes, Judy. The Mayfield case really highlights the questionable reliability of these type of identifications. Here we had a case where we had three FBI examiners who made the same misidentification, and then it was confirmed by an independent examiner who's considered to be at the top of the profession by other fingerprint examiners. In other cases of misidentification, we've had the government say, well, this might have just been a bad practitioner. But here we have examiners who are really considered at the top of the field making a misidentification. And but for the fortuity of having examiners in another country looking at the same print and being able to come up with a more compelling match, poor Mr. Mayfield would probably still be in jail today. And who knows how long he might be in jail for.
Pat Wertheim, throughout Brandon Mayfield and Stephen Wax's story, you were furiously writing there. I mean, is this, in your view, a one-off? And if so, what went wrong?
I think it probably is a one-off. I've seen the images myself, of course, on the Internet. I do not agree with the identification. I don't know how it occurred. I don't know any of the details, and I'm quite eager to hear what the panel that the FBI has announced they will convene has to say about it.
How rare is a mistake in fingerprinting, to your knowledge?
Well, with the FBI, their fingerprint section came into being in 1925, and this is the first time that we've heard of a fingerprint identification erroneously being made and acted upon. So in, 79 years, this is the first one that's come to our attention out of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of identifications during that time period.
Well, Robert Epstein, I think you'll disagree with that. That they're hidden, the mistakes?
Judy, we have no idea how many other cases of misidentification may have occurred that went undetected. This case would have gone undetected, but for the fact that we had examiners in another country taking a look at the print and that they were able to find a more compelling match that the FBI ultimately had to agree with. That's not the typical case.
We're going to talk about your case, Robert, straight right after the break. So, Connection listeners, what do you think? Is our faith in fingerprints misplaced? We'll be presenting you with the evidence. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking fingerprints this hour and whether we should trust them as evidence in court. My guests, Robert Epstein, a federal defender in Philadelphia. Pat Wertheim is a fingerprint analyst for the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Robert Epstein, we were about to go into your experience in the courtroom. You were saying the Brandon Mayfield case, not the first.
No, not. Definitely not. There's been other cases of misidentification that have come to light. There was recently a case in Boston where Stephen Cowens was in jail for 6 years for allegedly shooting a police officer, and he was ultimately exonerated. There was a bad fingerprint identification in that case. It was only when DNA evidence was tested that it was made clear that that fingerprint identification was erroneous. There have been other such cases from around the country and overseas.
You nearly succeeded, didn't you, in taking part, being part of a victory in court where the judge said fingerprints are not admissible as evidence.
That's right. In the case of United States versus Lira Plaza, the judge initially precluded the FBI examiners from giving any opinions of identification. And I think what the judge was relying upon there was the fact that there has never been any scientific testing done to establish the reliability of making identifications from the type of small, distorted, fragmentary prints that are typically recovered at crime scenes.
Well, let's bring in Pat Wertheim. Pat, how does it work? You're going to be a fingerprint analyst. First of all, are you trained and are you tested?
Yes. A fingerprint analyst should receive good training in all of the scientific underpinnings of the science, followed by competency testing to assure that they know what they're doing. In the United States, most state police agencies, if not all, follow this, as do the federal agencies. Most of the large city agencies do. Unfortunately, in the United States, there are no national standards for training or competency testing. And I believe that's probably the underlying cause of the vast majority of errors that could be pointed out.
You say that quite casually. It does seem absolutely astonishing that there's no national standard for competency, as you say. These are guys who could be sending somebody to the chair.
Absolutely. In the UK, the training period is from 3 to 5 years. In Australia, New Zealand, it's 5 years. Quite a rigorous training program down under. Unfortunately, in the United States, there are no training standards nor even competency testing requirements.
Are you saying that the science is good, but the way it is practiced in parts of the United States is wrong? Or is the science itself in question?
You've hit the nail on the head there, Judy. The science itself is reliable. The practitioner errors are the cause of concern. In any field of human endeavor, there exists the potential for human error. We do our very best to minimize that, but that potential still exists.
Yeah, Robert Epstein, you were talking about the case. I think Judge Pollack was involved. Judge Pollack accepted exactly what Pat said there, didn't he? Because he said, yes, you could not have a firm match as the only piece of evidence. But then when he heard from the FBI, he said, well, right, the majority of you guys, vast majority, get it right. And he overturned the verdict. He overturned his own judgment.
That's right. Judge Pollack was impressed by the FBI's testimony that there had never previously been any misidentifications by the FBI. Well, now in the Mayfield case, we see that the FBI certainly is capable of misidentification. And as we argued in front of Judge Pollack, we simply have no idea how many other cases of misidentification may have occurred where the FBI, just as in the Mayfield case, came into court and said they were 100% sure that they were able to make a match and that they were able to make the match to the exclusion of every other finger in the world, as fingerprint examiners always testify to. And it was our contention that there's simply no basis for fingerprint examiners to make such a claim.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ian's joining us from Scotland, Ian?
Yes, from Bonnie, Scotland, a long way away. I know Pat Wertheim. Pat Wertheim came over to the UK in 1999 and helped free my daughter from a charge of perjury when her fingerprint had been falsely found at a murder scene. So I have a lot to thank Pat Wertheim and David Grieve and American experts for, but I would like to agree, I agree with Pat Wertheim that the problems, in fact, is the proficiency of experts and also the lack of international standards, because this is an international problem. This is just not an American problem. This is happening all over the world. And my daughter has spent 8 years trying to prove these experts wrong, and these experts still fail to admit that they're wrong, despite the rest of the world saying they are. So unless you have international standards of fingerprinting, where are you? You have international organizations representing fingerprinting. You've got the International Association of Identification, and you've got the Fingerprint Society. Whenever these mistakes are made, these organizations disappear from sight. Now, unless these major organizations, these representative organizations for fingerprinting, stand up to be counted and point out the mistakes and throw these people out of the international profession, nothing will happen. So in supporting Pat Wertheimer, I do support him, and I believe I was a police officer for 30 years, and I believe that fingerprinting can be a science. But at the moment, it's a danger, and I agree with Robert Epstein in this. I believe many mistakes have been made. So I'm appealing for an international approach to this, and I'd be very interested what Pat and Mr. Epstein have to say about that.
Yeah, Pat, are there too many cowboys in your profession, and you're out there, you're a gunslinger having to go to Scotland to rescue the damsel in distress?
I love the term cowboys because the Scottish police services referred to me as a cowboy for coming over there to call them wrong in the first place.
Well, you shouldn't have worn your cowboy boots from Arizona, but anyway, carry on.
Ian, old friend, it's good to hear from you. And Ian is correct. The application of fingerprint identification varies from country to country, if not in actual practice, at least in the way it's presented in court. He's also correct that the major professional organizations, the International Association for Identification and the Fingerprint Society, neither have taken a position in regard to his daughter's case, an egregious case of erroneous identification, but not the only one that I uncovered in Scotland.
Robert Epstein, if you're out to discredit fingerprinting, is it the science itself that you're worried about, or are you worried about the practitioners?
I'm worried about both, Judy. I think when we talk about a science, what science basically is testing of a hypothesis. And the fundamental hypothesis in fingerprint analysis is that we can reliably make identifications from the type of small, distorted, fragmentary prints found at crime scene. Well, there simply hasn't been any scientific testing done to try to establish that. So the methodology of fingerprint analysis has never been tested. Then we have the problems with the practitioners and the fact that there's no standards, there's no minimum competency or training requirements in play for fingerprint examiners, which is really stunning when you think about it, the lack of training that a fingerprint examiner can have before he goes into the courtroom to testify. So I think there needs to be testing of the methodology to find out what are the error rates associated with fingerprint analysis for different types of latent prints. And there also needs to be standards put into play for fingerprint examiners before they're permitted to testify in court.
Well, let's have a quick A to Z of the, or Z, as you'd say, of the methodology. Pat Wertheim, first of all, is it absolutely certain that everybody has a completely individual fingerprint?
I can say that with fingerprint computers searching worldwide on a continual basis, no two fingerprints have ever been found to be the same. Those of us who have looked at the electronic images of Mayfield's would not say that that's an exception. Now, in that regard, Mr. Epstein's comment that there needs to be scientific testing of a hypothesis, I contend, has been done, not in a controlled laboratory study by laboratory practitioners in white coats, but over 100 years of empirical testing. The uniqueness and permanence of fingerprints are the underlying foundation, and there's been no dispute in court that those are, in fact, true. The methodology begins with an analysis of the latent print or the unknown print at three levels of detail. First, the overall pattern.
So you look at the whorls.
Whorls, loops, and arches, exactly.
And then you look at the points.
The points are the second level of detail.
Because in the random Mayfield case, they said that what people were looking at, the analyst looked at, was the points. And the points matched up, but they hadn't looked at the overall picture. It's like saying Mona Lisa's hair. She's got dark hair, she must be Mona Lisa, and forgot to look at the face.
Well, you know, I wish I knew more about what was done with the prints in the Mayfield case. I believe I see points in the latent that aren't in the inked, and likewise points in the inked print of Brandon Mayfield that are not present in the latent, but I don't know what happened in that case.
But isn't it an art, really? You're looking at a picture, aren't you? I mean, it's not done by a computer, is it?
Well, and this goes back to something else that Mr. Epstein said earlier. There are psychological dynamics present, and I agree with him completely. There needs to be a study of the psychology, as he said, of human memory and of the effect of suggestion on that. The whole process of recognition as it occurs in the human brain is a critical element of fingerprint identification that hasn't been studied.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dan's joining us from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hi, Dan, what's your point?
Hey, how you doing? My point was that there are times when fingerprint evidence is more reliable than other forms of identification because I have an identical twin brother.
That could be a problem.
We look exactly alike. Our DNA is exactly alike. The only way to differentiate us is by our fingerprints.
Yeah, okay. Robert Epstein brought up an interesting point there, similarity in DNA. I mean, nothing, no evidence is going to be 100%, is it?
That's correct. The example that the caller was giving would be where you have a comparison of a full fingerprint to a full fingerprint, which is very, which could would adequately distinguish between twins. But what we're dealing with in criminal cases is not a comparison of a full print to a full print. It's a comparison of a small distorted partial print found on a crime scene to a full print. And that's where the issue of reliability comes into play. The question really isn't the uniqueness of full fingerprints. The question is the reliability of taking a small distorted fragment and being able to make an absolute identification from that.
Pat Wertheim, is there a rule about how much of a fingerprint and how clear it is before it can be admissible in court?
There is a relationship between the quantity of detail and the quality of detail. And the combination of quantity and quality has to be sufficient to allow the individual examiner to reach the conclusion of positive identification. If there's insufficient combination of quantity and quality, then the results would be inconclusive. The examiner would say that this print is of no value for identification.
I must just quickly, we were discussing Sherlock Holmes before we came on air because I mentioned him in the opening. He apparently did use fingerprints, but to prove someone was innocent.
Yes, The Adventure of the Norwood Builder, which I believe Doyle wrote in 1891 and was published in 92. Or 92 and 93, I forget. And in that particular case, a bloody fingerprint at the scene of a murder was interpreted by Investigator Lestrade, I believe, to indicate guilt. But, of course, Sherlock Holmes was too smart for that, and he immediately recognized forged fingerprint evidence.
Forged fingerprint. There you go, Robert Epstein. Sherlock Holmes was on your side. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Matt's joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Hi. What's your point?
I was thinking about something else that was kind of like art and or science, and that was ballistic bullet printing. I heard a story not too long ago where people were actually that were revisiting some of the court cases because of this ballistic bullet printing, where you fire a bullet from a gun and you can trace it back to the gun itself. And it seems to me it's a lot like this fingerprinting thing that we're talking about right now, and that we've overextended ourselves on what we consider our capabilities to be with analyzing all of these prints.
It really does point up that everything that we thought was pure science is not pure science, doesn't it, Matt?
Yeah, it seems so. Also, I was thinking that this lawyer wouldn't have even had a problem at all if he had never just been in the military. It seems like they've really bloated up the database a great deal with just putting if you happen to be in the military, they put your fingerprints in there. And then, of course, that's how he got into trouble. And the fact that he was a Muslim didn't help him at all.
Pat.
Judy, one of the comments you just made in reference to pure science, and I think it's important to note that fingerprint identification would not be classified as pure science by any stretch of the imagination. It's an applied science, a forensic science, but there are those who would argue that the only pure science is mathematics.
But there's 44 million on the database, aren't there? So there's a lot of people missing from the database for a start.
Well, that's true. You've got the criminal files and the civil files, which are combined in the FBI's database.
And, of course, I've come through the airport, so I'll be on there. And Matt, as he says, he'll be on there as a military. I mean, is the database what you need? I mean, is that part of the problem?
There are some of us, myself included, who have been teaching in our courses and our training for years that as the size of the databases grow, the possibility of close matches becomes more problematic, and that as we go to larger and larger databases, we have to be continually more cautious about what we call a correct identification. There have been cases published in the local newsletters. There was a case published in the Journal of Forensic Identification about a year and a half ago, I believe, in which there have been 8 to 10 reasonably similar points of identification. But then if you go to that third level that we began to talk about a few minutes ago, you could easily distinguish between the two. My fear all along has been unqualified APHIS technicians who look only at the location of the points and don't look at the overall pattern and don't look at the finer detail for exclusion.
Robert Epstein, Matt made a good point. He says ballistics have been partly discredited. Certainly hair analysis, it's had its day in court several times over and been discredited. Now fingerprinting. DNA, of course. You can have DNA at the scene, but it doesn't necessarily mean you committed the crime. Do you think fingerprinting should be thrown out as evidence, or do you think that it's just, it's one of the tools, weapons in your trade to say it might not be categorical?
I think what we need in this, in the fingerprint field, is for real testing to be done so that the consumers of the testimony, the jury, the judge, the defendant, can have some level of assurance or some knowledge as to how accurate fingerprint analysis really is. And until the testing is done, it's been our contention that the testimony should not be permitted. The kind of testing we have been calling for is not very complicated and could be done. There's been a real reluctance, however, on the part of the government to undertake the testing. And one has to wonder why. If the FBI and the United States government believes that fingerprint analysis is as reliable as they claim it to be, why they would be so reluctant to go forward with the testing that would be able to give us real answers as to how accurate it truly is.
Connection listeners, we're talking about fingerprint evidence this hour and whether it should be accepted in court if execution could be the result. If fingerprint identification is fallible, what does that mean for you? 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking fingerprint evidence this hour, and do you have faith in it? Would you rely on it in court? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, Robert Epstein, who's Assistant Federal Defender in Philadelphia, and Pat Wertheim, who's a fingerprint analyst for the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Robert Epstein, first of all, you've talked about your lengthy court battles to try to get fingerprint evidence discredited. If it's so flawed, why haven't judges listened to you?
Well, I think judges have been very reluctant to throw out a law enforcement forensic identification technique that has been accepted in this country for the past 100 years. On the other hand, judges by and large have held that the defense should be permitted to call critics of the field to educate a jury as to the limitations of fingerprint analysis, the kind of things that I've been talking about today, the lack of testing that has been done, the lack of standards in the field. In fact, the
complete. But you say it's been accepted for 100 years. How did it get accepted 100 years ago if it's still dubious today?
Well, 100 years ago, judges were utilizing a different – trial judges were utilizing a different and less exacting test for the admissibility of expert testimony. And basically, the prosecution was permitted to call any expert of its choosing. So at that time, the government, the law enforcement, had very little difficulty getting fingerprint analysis into the courtroom. And there was no counter experts available to testify against fingerprint evidence. Fingerprint evidence didn't arise out of academia. It arose out of law enforcement. There was no academic studying the field that could have been called upon to question its reliability at that time.
Pat, is that right? Pat Wertheim?
Yes. The standards for admissibility of evidence have tightened significantly in the last 100 years. And I agree with Mr. Epstein. The initial introduction of fingerprint evidence was done under much looser standards than we have in court today. But some of the critics of fingerprint identification allude to a worldwide conspiracy of fingerprint experts to protect our position. And they even imply then that all of the judges are in on this massive conspiracy. And I think the truth is somewhat different. Fingerprints are still the most reliable means of identification. And these judges in multiple hearings have recognized that. Even Judge Pollack, when confronted with an actual hearing to listen to experts, reversed his original limitations on the evidence and allowed it all in.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sherwin's joining us from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hi, Sherwin, what's your point?
Hi, I just have one comment to make, and I'm wondering if, since we stumble upon this creation of reasonable doubt about the process that we use to send people to the electric chair and the gas chamber, if this is not, a time for us to declare at least a moratorium on the death penalty before we really analyze and perfect this process that we use to condemn people.
Sherwin, thanks for that point. Robert Epstein, this is quite a difficult point, isn't it? Because certainly the Massachusetts governor, Mitt Romney, said that he would not allow anybody to be executed if they reintroduced the death penalty unless the science was absolutely categorical. If fingerprinting is science, that would mean it was categorical.
That would be pretty scary. I would be horrified for someone to be executed on the basis of a fingerprint identification if that was the only real evidence in the case indicating guilt. Fingerprint analysis has not been tested as a science, and there are real questions about just how reliable it is. Now, there have been some alarm bells that have been going off as to how reliable this analysis really is. Fingerprint examiners have taken proficiency tests over the past 10 years or so. These aren't scientific tests. These are minimum competency tests that fingerprint examiners have taken for crime labs to become accredited. And there have been stunning amounts of misidentifications made on these minimum competency proficiency tests. In 1995, for example, 22% of the examiners who took the proficiency test made at least one misidentification, if not more. There's a certification test given by the Professional Association, and there's no certification requirement, and most fingerprint examiners are not certified. But of those who have taken the test, more than half have failed it.
Is that true, Pat?
Yes, it is, but you've got to...
Well, given all that, would you be comfortable if you found that someone was executed strictly on the basis of fingerprints?
Oh, I'd have to see the fingerprints. But then again, a fingerprint only proves that a person touched a surface. As you said with the DNA a minute ago, the fingerprint doesn't prove that the person committed the crime. Now, the failure rate on that certification test that Mr. Epstein referred to is on missed identifications, that is, failure to make correct identifications, rather than erroneous identifications. We hold in this field of science that it is far better to miss an identification, that is, to fail to make the identification, and that we should never make an erroneous identification. And that goes along with our legal principle, it's better to let a guilty man go free than to convict an innocent one.
Well, what do you think, Connection listeners? Do you think if we tighten the standards for fingerprint evidence, some criminals will go free, and is that a good thing? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike's joining us from Waltham, Mass. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you? I'm calling. I work for a fingerprint biometric company, and we do computer matching, so we're able to typically obtain 1,500 to 2,000 points of data per finger. I was wondering if you foresee the criminal system moving toward this sort of computer comparison that might capture more data points.
Is that true? Is that what's going to happen, Pat? Pat Wertheim.
Well, if Mike is finding that many data points in a fingerprint, then he's looking far deeper than just the level 2 detail, the ridge endings and the splitting ridges, which are currently used in APHIS. And there has been discussion in the field for years now about going to a level 3 recognition system, which is, I'm sure, what Mike is referring to with his corporation.
Mike, you want to come back on that?
Yes, that is. That's exactly what we're doing. We take the various minutia points, and then we look at their relation to each other, and different data points that are kind of created on a relational basis.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike, thanks for your point. Kamal is joining us from Newton, Mass. Kamal.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Your question.
My question is, I heard somewhere that the fingerprint pattern of an individual changes, through years. Like, for example, if someone was fingerprinted 30, 40 years ago, you won't have the same print today. Would that be true or not?
Kamal, I think I've got your answer. Pat was shaking his head on that one.
The
Pat.
Details that result on the surface of the skin are determined by the basal layer of the epidermis. In other words, the formation of the fingerprint on the surface comes from way down inside below the surface of the skin, and it remains permanent unless it's scarred or otherwise damaged. Now, there will be some changes, but for example, if you took a toy balloon with printing on it and you blew the balloon up big, you can't say that it hasn't changed, but the printing on the balloon will still read the same. As people age, the sweat glands cease to function, the skin gets smooth and dry and wrinkly, but those details that we look at for identification that are formed in the basal layer of the epidermis remain the same regardless of growth or aging.
Kamal, thanks for your call, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joe's joining us from Conroe of Texas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, good. You want to talk to Mr. Epstein, I gather?
Yes, I was wanting to ask him what his opinion was as far as all the positive identifications that have been made off of latent prints and how he felt about that. As far as the one erroneous print that was evidently made as far as the FBI, what's his opinion on all the positive identifications that have been made through latent fingerprints?
Robert Epstein, you can talk to Joe.
Well, Joe, I think we really don't have a good sense as to how many erroneous identifications might have been made in those cases that went undetected. Fingerprint analysis has been very under-scrutinized, to say the least, over the last 100 years. It's only been over the last few years that defense attorneys have been seeking to really ask serious questions about the reliability of the technique. So it's very hard to say how many cases of misidentification may have occurred that have gone undetected. When we take a look at the proficiency test results that I was referring to earlier, that would suggest, and the results on the certification test, that would suggest that there might be a significant number of misidentifications that have gone undetected. Mr. Mayfield's case probably would have gone undetected, but for the fact that we had examiners in another country who were comparing the same print, which is very atypical.
As far as, like, with the FBI doing an independent study, how would you feel about doing one yourself as far as the validity of the prints to make sure that there is no two people that have the same prints?
Well, I think testing should be done as to the question of uniqueness. It's never really been studied. And I think it would be important to do studies that would show what's the probability of two different people having similar fingerprints so that you take a latent fragment of a fingerprint and match it to multiple other fingers. The FBI in this case said that there was a remarkable similarity between the print found on the plastic bag in Spain and the print taken directly from Mr. Mayfield's finger. We have no idea what the probability is of that occurring. How often is it that two different people may have fingerprints that are remarkably similar?
Pat Wertheim, you were indicating you want to jump in there and holding up signs saying proficiency testing.
Yes. Robert Epstein has referred to the proficiency test, and while he made the comment that there have been numerous identifications on numerous of these, he cited the 1995 Collaborative Testing Service test, which unfortunately did have about a 20% erroneous identification rate, not a rate of missed identifications, but a rate of erroneous identifications. That test has been an anomaly, though, and I'm somewhat ambivalent about it because having taken the test myself and passed it, I feel like any qualified latent print examiner should have passed that 1995 test. But at the same time, the print that was misidentified or erroneously identified on that test by so many people was one that appeared to have been manipulated in an effort to trick the people taking the test. So I'm ambivalent about it. I don't think it's fair to try to trick fingerprint examiners on a test, but I think a cautious examiner should have realized that that was not a correct identification.
Which brings us back to the point, doesn't it, Robert Epstein? Is it the science that's bad or the system? If there were proficiency tests and a certain standard of evidence, there had to be enough of a clear print before it was used as evidence. Would you be comfortable with that?
It would make me certainly more comfortable. But the only way we're going to come up with a safe, reliable standard for examiners to use is if there's real science done, is if there's testing done to establish what that safe, reliable standard would be. So there has to be, in order to come up with the standard, there has to be some real science done in this field, science that has yet to be conducted.
Pat Wertheim, why haven't proficiency tests been brought in? Why hasn't fingerprinting been analyzed so it's known to what extent it is a science? Is it just a question of money?
Well, no. And there have been tests, or I should say scientific studies, beginning in 1892 with Francis Galton, who proposed a very crude statistical model or fingerprint identification. And that model has been refined by over a dozen researchers in the century since Galton. Statistics is not the way to approach a fingerprint identification because fingerprints are, in fact, unique biologically. That can be shown. And you cannot define uniqueness statistically. I think Judge Pollack hit the nail on the head with his second ruling, and that was that the reliability of the examiner through training, experience, and testing is the key to the reliability of the evidence they present in court.
There you go, the agenda for the future for those involved. My thanks to my guest today, Robert Epstein, an assistant federal defender in Philadelphia, and to my studio guest, Pat Wertheim, fingerprint analyst for the Arizona Department of Public Safety. Earlier we heard from Brandon Mayfield. He's the attorney based in Oregon, and Stephen Wex is a federal public defender, his attorney for the District of Oregon. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenelosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugatz. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.